Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. So as we're sitting here, the Senate is getting closer to a deal on the $2 trillion spending package. What could possibly go wrong? Domestic airlines are reportedly considering a voluntary complete shutdown of domestic flights. How about that for being apocalyptic? And apparently the Olympics are going to be postponed. Meanwhile, we hear out of the White House that the president's losing patience with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's leading expert in infectious diseases, because Dr. Fauci continues to have this thing about, you know, telling the truth and correcting the president and relying on facts. But maybe the most disturbing thing that happened, I don't really know if this is disturbing or not, but late last night, I tweeted out, serious question, what is the earliest respectable time that I can start drinking bourbon tomorrow? Asking for a friend. Strictly theoretical. Now, you know what's disturbing about this? That as of right now, I have more than 2,200 responses to that. 501 retweets and 8,200 likes, which suggests that a lot of people are thinking the same thing. So you kind of wonder what's going on out there. And the vast majority of responses are it's always bourbon time somewhere. That if you don't start early, you can't drink all day. I don't know. So joining me on today's podcast, Kim Whaley, who is one of our regular contributors, a former assistant U.S. attorney, former associate independent counsel in Whitewater investigation, visiting professor at the American University, Washington's College of Law, CBS News analyst, BBC News contributor, and the author of How to Read the Constitution and Why. Which means, Kim, that you are like way overqualified for today's podcast.
I'm always happy to be here, Charlie.
Well, I want to start off with the controversy over reopening America. I have a piece up at the Bulwark that Trump's next pivot is going to leave the country more divided than ever. And I talked about this with Benjamin Wittes yesterday from Lawfare, and he was skeptical. He just didn't think that the president would do something as crazy as prematurely reopening the country for business because it would be such a disaster, running for reelection while the death toll is ticking up, the practical problems of reopening the economy before you've solved the coronavirus, not to mention the constitutional problems of the fact that most of the shutdowns have been ordered by state governors and local communities. So it's not clear what the president can do, but the president is apparently he's listening to folks who are saying that the cure is worse than the disease and the cure is the shutdown of the economy. And so for those of you that think that the president is not capable of doing this, I want to play something for you. And I want to acknowledge this comes from Media Matter for America, which is not a popular site among conservatives for a lot of valid reasons, but they put together a supercut of folks generally on Fox News using this talking point. And this is kind of an interesting moment, how a talking point becomes viral. And, you know, kind of spoiler alert here, one of the points that I want to make is that Donald Trump is not a leader, he's a follower. And once his base heads in a certain direction, the odds are overwhelming that he is going to follow it. Now, this, of course, is a unique circumstance. But just listen to this little supercut, about a minute and a half, of all of the ways in which people in Trump world use the exact same phrase. And let's play this.
Our ruling class and their TV mouthpieces whipping up fear over this virus, they can afford an indefinite shutdown. Working Americans can't. They'll be crushed by it. You know that famous phrase, the cure is worse than the disease? That is exactly the territory we are hurtling towards.
The economic devastation to families would be so severe that I really believe that the cure is worse for than the disease.
Become worse than the disease.
Worse than the disease.
This virus will be a problem until about 60% of the American population gets the virus, so we have what's called herd immunity. That's a scary thing. But what's also scary is if you lock down the economy, it may be impossible to start up again. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the cure can be worse than the disease.
The president, at 10 minutes before midnight last night, tweeted this out. He said, "We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. At the end of the 15-day period, we will make a decision as to which way we want to go.
So the president is correct. You don't want the cure to be worse than the disease. And right now, the cure, the current cure, is worse than the disease.
But the president is right. The cure can't be worse than the disease. And we're going to have to make some difficult trade-offs.
What do you think he means by that?
Well, I believe that he means that the potential economic and financial devastation may outweigh that of the virus itself. And I do agree with that.
Wow. So, Kim Whaley, just some thoughts about the herd mentality out there.
Well, to me, it feels like propaganda, simple responses to very complex problems. And we don't have leadership in this moment from at the federal level. And that's absolutely devastating. As you mentioned, the president doesn't have the power to snap his fingers and reopen the economy. We have a global economy. So there's many other countries on the planet that are taking greater steps to, quote, shut down the economy to save lives within their borders. So he can't affect that, number one. Number two, as you mentioned, we also have something called federalism in this country, which means that states have their own sovereignty and they can make their own decisions when they're within their borders. That's number two. I mean, the federal government has some power to trump that, pun intended. But nonetheless, he doesn't have complete control over all state and local governments. And number three, of course, as you mentioned, with the airline industry, it's just one example, the private sector also can make its own decisions as to how to keep their workers, individual companies, to keep their workers safe. I have a family member who's very senior in a publicly traded company, and she's really struggling with that very issue. So this is not all something that Trump can control. And I wonder if this is really an excuse to not do what is necessary to slow the spread of the virus and save lives. We're going to see many, many, many people die very horrible deaths in this country. And given that he doesn't have the power to reopen the global economy with the stroke of a pen or a tweet, it makes me wonder if these are talking points for the election.
You know, we just really need to pause for a moment. This cliche that the cure is worse than the disease. Have they really thought through what they are saying? Because as you just pointed out, the disease, you know, by some estimates, if we didn't have an aggressive mitigation program, might kill 2.2 million Americans. 2 million Americans. Even hundreds of thousands of Americans would be a national disaster. There are some estimates that we could have 20 million people in the hospitals. Now, those are probably on the outliers. So, you know, dial that back. But we are still dealing with a human tragedy on a massive scale. And I guess, you know, part of me is I'm sitting back and thinking, I'm old enough to remember when conservatives were pro-life. And when you have people like the lieutenant governor of Texas going on television and saying grandparents should be basically willing to die or take risks in order to protect the economy for their grandchildren, it's like, wait. The trade-off between the economy and the mass loss of human life, really, have you thought through what you mean when you say the cure is worse than the disease? But, you know, Kim, I guess even the president talking about this can do real damage, because there's kind of a moment where the nation is kind of, you know, getting positioned to take collective action with some pretty good spirits. But, you know, he can unravel all of this with a single press conference, you know, basically turning social distancing from an act of civic responsibility into another signal of tribal identity. And I wrote about that today. You know, this country is divided, you know, whether you're talking about the patchwork of blue versus red states, but also there are polls showing that a lot of conservatives and Republicans, I'm really sorry to say this, just simply do not take this seriously as others. And so here you have a president who, you know, has been up until 5 minutes ago is declaring he's a wartime president, but a lot of his base never took that war seriously. So he's sending out a signal here that could unravel a lot of the social cohesion. And then the impact, as you mentioned, on public health can be dramatic and can be tragic. And we could end up with the worst of all possible worlds, which is that you try to restart the economy, people no longer engage in the social distancing, the pandemic comes back, and so you have a pandemic and an economy in the tank. And so that's that's where this moment is like, you know, you hope that he's going to be listening to the adults in the room, if there are any adults in the room, to use that really worn out old cliche.
Well, I wonder if individual Americans are going to start listening to the adults in their own rooms, in their own homes. I mean, this is a person who is incapable of leadership in this moment. Listen, we've all seen the graphs. This is not really, I mean, I'm not a medical expert. I'm not an economist, but the viruses don't care about politics. They don't care about money. They don't care about influence. They don't care about the election. This particular virus is really lethal and really brutal. And it's clear how you slow it down. You slow it down by minimizing contact with people that are infected. You slow it down by identifying infected people and trying to trace backwards to quarantine those that might have been exposed to that infection. You slow it down by massive amounts of testing to identify where there are clusters of disease. This is really well established. Without those things, there is 100% chance we will see massive suffering and death. And this is not an easy death from what I understand. That's number one. So I agree with you. The fact that we're even having this conversation is a bit mind blowing. But we've been living in an alternative universe of facts. And I tend to be hopeful. And I'm hoping that because, you know, Mother Nature is more powerful than lies and deceit, really, at the end of the day, people are going to have to pay attention to the truth, because there's going to be so much tragedy across this country. The other piece that I think your commentary touches on is this crisis of humanity and compassion that we've been building towards. It's been crescendoing in this country now for several years. This idea that we can let our basic human instincts and respect for in this moment, human life at the door, and have a functioning society, that too is coming. It's coming to a head. It's crescendoing. And we'll just have to see. I mean, it'll be interesting in a year. I'll be sad in a year to have this conversation and see if some of these more natural positive instincts of humanity are going to outweigh this insanity, frankly, that is coming from certain parts of the political spectrum.
We are being tested. I mean, the reality is that at some point the economy will have to be restarted. I mean, at some point people are going to go back to work, right? I mean, kids are going to go back to school. We're going to have sports again. Restaurants and gyms are going to reopen. We're going to have the nation's culture start up again. I guess the question is not whether or not to revive the economy. It's when to do it and how to do it. And I guess this is where I think people are legitimately nervous. How do you think Trump's going to do it? Is he going to do it carefully, or is he going to do it impulsively?
Well, I think you can answer that, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, is he going to do it in concert or in defiance with the medical experts? And that, I think, is what makes this moment so dangerous, because this is a man who not only lacks empathy, his lack of respect for expertise is now potentially deadly as well.
Well, I mean, he's a narcissist, malignant narcissist. I mean, again, I'm not a psychologist, but there are psychologists that have weighed in on that. He makes decisions based on what's best for himself. And we see with his public presentations where he's really kind of like kicked Dr. Fauci to the side that it's almost painful to watch, because it's like these uncomfortable temper tantrums. It's like irrational. He almost seems like there's something, you know, really wrong with him psychologically. We do not have leadership at the federal level. Look at China. China has flattened the curve. And how did they do it? They did a massive lockdown. It took about 4 to 5 weeks. So we know how to get the economy going. This is again, it's not complicated. I mean, I'm sure it's complicated to execute, but I'm saying in the pieces that need to be in place, it's a matter of logic. This tiny little virus likes to jump around, and it likes to hang around in people's bodies for 2 to 3 weeks and then show its ugly face, so to speak. We all have to basically get on top of this virus and beat down this virus. And, you know, so we sit at home for 4 weeks. It's going to be massively economically damaging. And then you slowly come out of the shadows and start the economy again. But if we don't have the shutdown, the virus is just going to keep spreading. So we're actually prolonging the economic damage.
Exactly.
It's kind of like, imagine if you've got to have a surgery, right? We all have jobs, but you have to have a surgery. You know, you're going to be out for 3 weeks. You just deal with it somehow. You deal with it with your job. You figure out, you know that's going to take a chunk out of your economic situation potentially. You just hunker down and do what has to be done because the medical issues have to come first. They just do. Because you can't function and if you're not healthy, it's the same. And so again, Charlie, it's really, you know, you and I've talked so many times about impeachment, about all of the insanity with this particular presidency. And the fact we're in a global pandemic of historic proportions with this person in the White House, there are no words for how terrifying that is. I think it's going to come down to individual responsibility and people going back to their own humanity and logic and good decision making for their families.
As a longtime pro-life conservative, I do find this very, very disoriented, including and leaving Trump out of the picture for the moment, to watch what passes for the conservative intelligentsia now making this pivot. So, I mean, the Federalist has, I think, become almost a cliche for being an early indicator of the worst aspects of Trumpism. But I mean, I'm just sitting here reading an article from a publication that, you know, again, was founded in order to be culturally conservative. And they're saying, there's a piece by a woman named Joy Pullman. Is it right for the nation to require our children's future be destroyed to keep alive less than 1% of our population until the next flu season? And then she's arguing there are worse things than allowing people to die. My point here is not that I like people dying. It's that very often our society chooses to allow deaths because the alternative is worse. I mean, it's just like, okay, you're just kind of just laying this out. And there are folks who are just saying that, yeah, we need to do this, even if there are going to be casualties. You know, when my own Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, you know, said that, well, you know, it's, you know, only 3.4% of the population is going to die. We have lots of people who die on the highways. We don't shut down the country. People thought that was a gaffe. Instead, it starts to be, you know, and it turns out to be this leading edge. And I think the only way to really explain it is another indication of the obsession with protecting Trump over everything, this growing anxiety, panic that this could cost Trump re-election, and we must defend Trump, we must protect him at all costs, and you know, folks in the Federalist world would accuse people like us of suffering from Trump derangement syndrome. This is really Trump derangement syndrome, because if you're willing to give up your respect for human life because you think it's so important to protect Donald Trump's political future, there's something seriously wrong with you. Okay, now I want to make a pivot here because you mentioned something that's really important, which is that one of the things about this pandemic and pandemics like this is the fact that they often come in waves. It's not a matter of just flattening the curve and having it go away. You can flatten the curve, but there might be a resurgence. And we saw that with the Spanish flu. I'm looking at a chart here showing, in fact, that even with mitigation efforts, that we might have a recurrence once the summer is over. And I'm looking at the chart. And one thing that really hits me is that the recurrence of the infections and the death rate might take place this fall in the midst of the campaign. And look, I really resist being, I'm cynical, but I'm not paranoid. But I have to say, and I've raised this in several podcasts now, and I know that you have been thinking about this a lot. How worried should we be about the impact of this pandemic, this sense of national crisis, on the 2020 election? And I don't mean the result of the election. I mean the existence of the election.
You know, I'm very worried. I think when you think about voting and elections and primaries, people think, oh, that's a little bit quaint. That's really not quite serious in the moment. We have all these other issues. But it is the heart and soul of all of it, right? I mean, again, we went through impeachment, and you and I have talked about how essentially the way the federal level government is working now is that Congress is not holding the president accountable. The courts aren't holding the office of the presidency accountable. And we even heard on the Senate floor during the trial, listen, the way to hold our elected officials in the White House accountable is in the 2020 election. So essentially, at the end of the day, our entire democratic system hinges on November 2020. And we're seeing things just close close because the virus is just creeping us up on us day by day. I mean, no one expected Disney World and airlines and Broadway, right, and all of this is happening. And people have asked me many times, you know, could the president cancel elections, or could Congress cancel elections?
And,
you know,
and my answer to that is always never. No, no way. That's crazy talk. But it's
I think it's almost the wrong question. Okay. The president couldn't do it. Congress could, at least at the federal level. But the issue is really a matter of pragmatics. We don't have a system where people can vote across the country by mail or from home. It doesn't exist. There's only four or five states that exclusively allow voting by mail-in ballots. The rest of the 50 states, you have to physically go to the polls. If we're in a certain a lockdown like we are now, people will be exercising their right to vote at their own personal peril. And essentially, this virus is such that we almost are, if you do have it, you're sort of a weapon walking around. I mean, you have to worry about sort of infecting other people. So we could wake up one morning. I think it's quite realistic, given what's happening day by day right now. We could wake up one morning and all of a sudden, like the Olympics, it's just not going to happen because it can't. The virus got ahead of it. Then where are we? We are in a position where we aren't even able to weigh in on how the federal government has handled a crisis where, I mean, people can talk about, you know, the cure being harder than the disease, but that's going to, I think, shift when we see the deaths that could flow from no intervention. As you mentioned, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of deaths. And these deaths, people feel pretty much comfortable within 3 hours or gasping for air on a respirator. This is a brutal process. So I think it's entirely possible that it won't happen. And then it raises a whole host of questions. That is, who is going to be in charge in the January 2021 when the Constitution says the presidential baton needs to be handed off? Then what are we anymore? Congress has to pass as part of this bill. I heard through colleagues that there is provisions in this bill, the House version, to basically allow mail-in voting at the federal elections for the fall. I think it's absolutely vital. There's no way the states would get up to speed on this between now and November so that everybody has the ability to vote. And I think with the trajectory we're going, particularly if the federal government is not going to do what's necessary to flatten the curve, and as you said, to maintain that flat curve, that is to be testing people constantly to get ahead of a new outbreak. It's just amazing. We don't even have tests, right? The first thing was January 22nd, the first confirmed case. We don't have tests that are accessible to everybody in this moment. It's absolutely stunning. I think that, you know, we could be in a situation where it just doesn't happen because it can't. Yeah. It can't.
Okay, so let's just slow the roll here a little bit, because and I'm reading something you wrote here, that this would be what we're describing is something that would be historically without any precedent whatsoever. I mean, we have never postponed a national election indefinitely. I mean, it didn't happen in 1864 in the midst of the Civil War. It didn't happen in World War I. It didn't happen in World War II. It didn't happen after September 11th. I mean, we've done a lot of things in the name of emergencies, as you point out, including, you know, incarcerating 200,000 Japanese Americans. But we've never pushed back an election. And as you point out, the president can't postpone the election. It's hard for me to imagine the Democrats in Congress would go along with postponing the election. So, I'm also watching Republicans around the country pushing back on the idea of making it easier to vote via absentee ballot or by mail. So, I mean, we are headed for a real crunch. I mean, you say it can't take place, but I mean, who would stop it? Part of it is that you can't get your head around what's going on. And the reason why I'm taking this really seriously as a possibility is we've already gotten inured to it. All of these primaries being canceled. I'm thinking right now, I live in you know, southeastern Wisconsin, that the Democratic National Convention scheduled for Milwaukee will not take place. So we are canceling primary elections. We might not have a major national presidential nominating convention. So the public is getting inured to the idea that in an emergency, these things can be movable, but I just don't see the mechanism by which it's movable.
Yeah. And imagine everything stays the same and no one issues some kind of legislation or order to postpone or cancel the election, okay? But we're where we are now in some measure, where people are afraid, right. Okay? So November 4th comes around. Who's going to run the poll stations? Who's going to physically be there to check people in, to check IDs? I mean, it's not realistic as a matter of just core logic. The Brennan Center for Justice has looked at this very carefully. It's going to take $2 billion that's their estimate, to essentially retrofit the national election system so that we can all vote by mail. People tend to vote by mail in higher numbers if that's available. And of course, there's a lot of elements that would need to be addressed, including making sure that identities are accurate, but that can be done with barcodes and other ways. Some people don't have access to mail, so there have to be drop-offs. I mean, there's a lot that would have to happen between now and November to make this stick. But I can't emphasize, as we've talked about before, as a matter of American democracy, I mean, that is the heart of the ability to decide our own government and to essentially have our sense of our own self-government is that November 4th election. I mean, we don't know when it would happen again. Maybe they would postpone it to February or something, but what does it do to kind of symbolically the heart of our system? This coronavirus strain, my understanding is this isn't the last time we're going to see a virus like this. This needs to be fixed now.
So let's assume that the election does take place in November, because it's hard to imagine the action doing it. But the circumstances that you're describing still being in place, I think you make a very interesting point in this piece that I'm reading here, that if you don't have federal legislation, we could have this inevitable hodgepodge of outcomes, including massive disenfranchisement and skewed results. You know, if only a fraction of committed voters are brave enough to go to the polls, if that's what they have to do. And so we'd be faced with a crisis of legitimacy. The outcome of the election would have a huge cloud over it. And, you know, of all of the awful things we've experienced, having an election that is that questionable, that would do long-term damage. So I guess the question is, what actually could the federal government do to prevent that outcome? Practically speaking, what is Amy Klobuchar suggesting we do?
So almost every state has some measure of mail-in or absentee ballots. Like I said, there's only a handful that allow the entire election by absentee ballots. And most states have requirements to be able to use an absentee ballot. You have to have an excuse. So her legislation, along with Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, would be to essentially allow everyone across the country to vote by mail without an excuse. You wouldn't have to come up with a justification, because right now, every state has its own laws governing voting and election. I have a new book coming out in June called What You Need to Know About Voting and Why, and it sort of lays all of that out. But I think this surprises most Americans, because we assume voting is the heart and soul of democracy. It is.
Yes.
But it's not even in the Constitution. There's no express right to vote in the original Constitution. The framers couldn't really come up with a system. The states really wanted to protect their own prerogative. So that's essentially what we're left with, a state-by-state system. Some people's right to vote is much more robust than others based on what your zip code is. But the Constitution does allow Congress to come in and, at least with respect to federal elections, pass nationwide legislation. So what would have to happen is legislation that essentially allows, even if it's just for November, mail-in ballots for all eligible voters. And then we would have to have sufficient money allocated to put in place systems for validating voter identity, translating ballots into other languages. There's federal law that requires that. Getting an online system in place so people can ask questions if they're confused. And then, of course, if people make errors with their ballots, that there's a system in place to allow those to be corrected so that people's votes count. The other piece is, a lot of states, even if they allow absentee voting, the law only will allow the state to count the votes after November 4th. So Senator Klobuchar's legislation would say, listen, once, as they're coming in, we should count them. And it's really hard, Charlie, to make a good faith argument that this shouldn't happen. I mean, we're all home, we're all anxious, and we're all, to some measure, living in fear. And one, in my life anyway, my personal life, one way of countervailing that sense of fear is a sense of control, that you can do something. Why can't we just sit at home and vote? It just seems pretty straightforward, but getting it through Congress is another matter. And I really think now is the time with this major relief package. It seems highly unlikely that the Democrats could do a second wave and have the political fortitude or the ability to do it later. It seems like now is the time to do this.
Yeah, it does seem that way. Unfortunately, and of course, these things are moving so quickly. It's hard to pin it down. But I think some of the Democratic proposals seem to be somewhat exploitative, as well as the Republicans. Look, I mean, that $500 billion slush fund for Steve Mnuchin was absolutely obscene. But there were all these reports that Democrats were pushing through a lot of their Christmas tree wish list, including, you know, money for, you know, cultural centers and, you know, forgiveness of student loans and blah, 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 blah. But this does seem to be related to the crisis. This is not a one-off. And I'm hoping that this doesn't get thrown in with all of the other, you know, look, we need to have a cleaner bill, no extraneous policy, because among the things that we have to decide right now, and we can't really wait until August to do this, is to say, okay, how will this pandemic affect the election? And can we take steps to protect the integrity of this election? That ought to be a bottom line. And I would like to think that you're right, that there's no good faith argument against it. But of course, that assumes that people need to have good faith. I mean, I'm already seeing press releases from, say, the Wisconsin Republican Party saying we can't loosen the requirements in absentee balloting because, of course, that will lead to more voter fraud, et cetera. And of course, that's a constant theme, you know, voter integrity. And so I see that lining up along partisan lines as well, which, again, could mean that you have this blue-red divide where you have two different countries voting in two different ways. And what are the implications of that going to be?
Yeah, in writing the next book on voting, I was really struck by the sort of constant undercurrent from the sort of the creation of our republic, this debate between the right to vote and whether only the right people should vote, that access to the ballot has been sharply debated and disputed and challenged from day one. And I think one of the biggest problems right now with people going to the polls is they think their vote doesn't matter and they feel that sort of disenfranchised and cynical. But if it didn't matter, people wouldn't be trying so hard to limit access. And so I think you put your finger on something again that seems like logical. It seems like, okay, we should all be able to vote. Not so. I think this is a pitched battle. This is not something that would be easy to put forth and get passed by both houses of Congress. And I completely agree with you. This kind of pork stuff that pet projects, I mean, it's, you know, there are lives on the line in this moment. And it's really demoralizing sometimes to see that people can't put rational thought and caring ahead of all of this political stuff. But that's been the case from day one. It's human nature, right?
Yeah. Well, it was Rahm Emanuel who said, never let a crisis go to waste. Okay. So flipping back to this question of government powers in time of crisis, this, you know, as when I was younger, my father was actually chairman of the Wisconsin Civil Liberties Union before it lost its mind. So I always sort of grew up with a libertarian streak. And one of the things that we always talked about was how dangerous the quote unquote national crisis is to the Bill of Rights and to the sense of government limitations. And we have had long talks about the rule of law. And one of the things I've really learned from you, Cam, is that the Constitution is not self-enforcing, that it's like we have to protect it. Otherwise, these things are gone. And we've seen how a lot of those guardrails can get blown away. But at a moment like this, strikes me as a moment of great peril. You and I certainly want us to take significant action to protect the public health. But there is a line out there for having the government take powers that we would not normally grant it in a democratic society. Where are those lines for you?
Yeah, great question. And it's not just sort of pundits and legal experts, but philosophers have debated this. You know, it's a balancing act, right? We have individual rights, the Bill of Rights, that are expressed in the Constitution. But as you mentioned, they're only so good as you can go to court and enforce them. That's not really self-executing. But the whole idea is to keep government off your back, is to limit the imposition of government in your lives. And then you've got a crisis like this. This concept of an emergency goes back to 18th century English philosopher John Locke, who talked about the public good, the interest in the public good being in emergencies, in some instances, superseding the interests of the individual. And I think we know this in terms of collective action. I would say, as far as where I come down on it, I mean, I really believe that we need to elect leaders who are competent. And I think that's what in this moment is different from other circumstances, and why, back to the notion of voting, why that's so crucial. But of course, as we talked about at the top of the show, I mean, at this point, the virus is taking over, right? People are going to die 100%. So I think that's kind of the exigency. That's the emergency, that, you know, it's almost like, okay, if you're in triage and your hand's cut off, the fact that you have an ear infection is going to have to wait. And I'm not starting to suggest that individual rights are to be marginalized. It's very, very important. When we get through this crisis, if we can get on top of it, then the question will become, as a society, what limits do we want to put in place legislatively within our elected officials to make sure that whoever is in power the next round is exercising that massive authority in a way that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you might have seen the tweet of Boris Johnson's, Prime Minister of it. Yeah, his 4-minute speech, where very measured, thoughtful, explained why he's keeping people in their homes. And I think if people understand the rationale behind it and the facts that are giving rise to that decision, they'll go along with it. I mean, we stop at stop signs, right? We buckle our seatbelts. I mean, Ronald Reagan came into office sort of promising to get rid of a seatbelt law. And that was a fight that ended up in the Supreme Court of the United States. But now we all do it because we understand that it saves lives, even though the government could give you a ticket for not strapping yourself into your car, which is a limitation on your ability to move, right? So it comes from good government explaining the various competing issues and making good, honest, thoughtful decisions. Yeah.
You know, you raise an interesting point here, and this is probably going to be a wild digression that I'm going to regret. But, you know, the whole point about why we stop for stop signs, you know, well, because, well, you know, we get a ticket, right? We might get arrested if we go through it. But the reality is that most of the time, the cops aren't at every intersection. They're not there to enforce it all the time. So it is a social norm. It's because, you know, it is the right thing to do. It is the prudent thing to do. And it has been internalized. In the same way, the social norms. But if we lived in a society where people thought that you were, you were caving in, or that you were a cuck for stopping at stop signs, that it was not necessary, it would be a very, very different society. And that's kind of where we're at with the virus. And I'm glad you mentioned the Boris Johnson. That was a bad digression. But the Boris Johnson speech, and I'm not always a Boris Johnson fan, but in 4.5 minutes, and people should go and look for this video. He very succinctly states the danger, states what the policy is, and makes an appeal to people to, you know, engage in the civic responsibility. And you look at that and go, this is what leadership looks like. This is a clear, cogent policy. And it is so dramatically different than what we are getting from the White House, which makes things more difficult. By the way, keeping up with the news is very difficult. While you and I were speaking here, just in, the Prime Minister of India has announced that India will go under complete lockdown starting Wednesday.
Yeah, India. I mean, I've been waiting for that in the United States. I mean, it's sort of, that is what it's, that level of care is what it's going to take to really get ahead of this particular virus. And have the authority, the president has the authority to do it. He just won't do it.
Yeah, but it also this underlies how absurd it is for the president, who, of course, you know, does not want to think in global terms, to think that somehow we can restart the economy without solving the disease. and this obsession among the part of, you know, much of Trump world that all of this is overhyped in order to bring down Donald Trump. Well, how do they explain what's going on around the world?
Exactly. We're not
an island here.
It's a ruse. The problem is that, you know, people understandably listen to that. I mean, I remember, my grandparents lived through World War II. They had, you know, not educated, seventh grade educations, salt of the earth people, right? But I remember going to the FDR Memorial with them in Washington, D.C. And when they saw the statue of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, there was almost this somber hush that went over them. There was so much reverence for him having brought them through that crisis as a society. I mean, obviously it was before my time, so I can't relate to it personally, but it really struck me as a young person to see their whole demeanor shift. And it's really a tragedy for people going through, all of us who are going through this really, really hard, uncertain time, to not have that kind of leadership. That alone, I think, psychologically and in terms of cohesion as a society, is really sad. It's a real tragedy for our population in this moment.
And yet the most recent polls would suggest that narrowly Americans approve of the way Trump is handling this. His approval ratings are up. He's above 50% in the approval rating for all of this.
Well,
is that simply a rally around the flag phenomenon?
Well, you know, I was listening to your podcast with our mutual friend A.B. Stoddard earlier, and I would agree with her, which I am paraphrasing. The answer is we'll see where that goes when this is really widespread and affecting, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands of lives. I mean, that's, I think, it, like anything, it's easy if it's theoretical to say it doesn't affect me, and so that's somebody else. But I think if it stays on this trajectory, we'll be having a different conversation, because it will be making its way into people's homes. And I understand the economic argument is that if you're not sick and you don't go to work, you're going to basically stand behind the president and putting the economy first. But again, if the statistics are right, which it seems like globally they are, without measures to stop the virus, that's just not going to be the case in the coming weeks.
Well, that's true. And somebody pointed out that back in the 1970s, during the Iran hostage crisis, Jimmy Carter's approval rating spiked up into the 60s during the crisis. But by the time, you know, as it was dragging on, it dropped down below 40%. And we know what happened eventually to Jimmy Carter. So these things have unpredictable trajectories at the moment. And Donald Trump, you know, simply really can't decide what he wants to be. Does he want to be the wartime president? Does he want to be the president who revives the economy? This is a dangerous moment for him, I think, is putting it mildly. But of course, it's not just for him. It's for all of us. Kim Whaley, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the podcast today.
Thank you, Charlie. It was a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.